Welcome to Podnet's Computer Repair Podcast, episode number 250, Customer Relationship Management. I'm your host, Jeff Hallish. This is our live call-in show for computer repair techs. We answer your questions on running your computer repair business. Call-in number is 1-888-697-0162. The Computer Repair Podcast is brought to you by Ninja, the simple-to-use remote monitoring and management solution. Try it free at info.ninjamsp.com/podnuts. Let me introduce the co-hosts. We have John Dubinsky from the Maven Group. How are you doing, John?
I'm just one happy MSP to another, Jeff.
You know I love you. And also joining us, we have Rob Lavelle from Uppercase Computer Solutions and BusyBench. How you doing, Rob?
Hey, doing great. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. All right, let's go ahead and start off the show as we normally do. And John, since you cry about being first all the time, we're going to go ahead and give it to you. Why don't you share a tip or story with us that we could learn from?
All right, so I'm going to jump on the SSD bandwagon again and go back to something I've talked to a little bit about before, because I got quite a few emails. I think we've talked about this on the show before, Jeff. You and I have talked privately a little bit about it, to go SSD or to go standard SATA drive and all that kind of stuff. I've embraced the SSD model, but I've been sort of embraced it that everything I'm replacing now, and probably even in my servers moving forward, I'm going straight SSD for everything. Yeah, I know. But I also do good backups, so fingers crossed. I'm a Western Digital fanboy, and for several reasons. Even my external drive that I carry in my bag that I image to and everything is a portable SSD now, because it saves me about a whopping 6 minutes in speed time when I do an image, so my time is money. But I'll put a couple of links in the show notes on some of the products I use. But the main reason, and no matter what vendor you choose, whether you're a WD guy or not, I chose WD so I could master one product line. If you know anything about Western Digital, they have about 17 different colors of drives. So you have to sort of build an understanding between black, blue, red. I think we actually have a purple now, and black. So, you know, any product you use, you want to be able to master that product line and master that brand. The WD drives come with very good software for not only diagnostics, but for consistent and reliable firmware updates and performance tuning. And the other great thing about WD is I can do my RMAs online at a web page without talking to a human being with absolutely no problems. So, you know, that's just my little tip of the week. I like it. I'm going on the SSD bandwagon. I like WD. And one last little tidbit tip is you're probably going to need this if you're watching the video. It's called an IC dock. So if you have a 2.5-inch SSD and you're dropping it into a full-size desktop and a 3.5-inch slot, you'll need a good dock. I've tried about a zillion of them. As you all know, I try just about everything. Too much. But this is the best I've found. It's great. It's plastic. It's lightweight. You can actually mount two SSD drives in the same spot as one 3.5-inch with this device. So very handy. And I'll put all those links in the show notes for everybody.
Well, thank you, John. That's yeah, it sounds good. I like how you said stick with a brand and learn it and know it well. I see too many people nowadays trying to jump all over and get stuff for the cheapest price. And that's not what it's about, folks. It's about getting a quality product that you can use and you know, like the back of your hand, because price does sometimes matter.
Well, in the end, what you want to do is avoid a truck roll. You don't want to have to go to replace something or battle a firmware issue for an hour, or, you know, have to deal with an RMA process that sucks up a lot of your time. So, you know, all of those are in the value of the price that you originally pay for the product you're purchasing.
Excellent point. All right, and Rob, what do you have for us this week? And I know I probably didn't let you know that we do this, and I can't remember the last time if you were on the show, if we did a tip or trick. But anyways, I'm sure you've got something in your plethora of things that you do on a regular basis that you could let people know about.
Yeah, I did space that out a little bit. But it did, when he was actually talking about the Western Digital stuff, he talks with a lot of enthusiasm, you know, and that's almost exactly the same way that I talk about the Ubiquiti stuff. So I'm going to kind of follow that same lead. I did the exact same thing he did, where we basically attached, as much information as we could to a single product. And that's why we ended up rolling with the Ubiquity line of products. And we ended up doing, I can't even tell you how many additional sales and additional jobs, because we picked one product that we knew the ins and outs of. And Ubiquity itself has, a lot of times they're seen for the higher end, like the point-to-point fiber and stuff like that. They actually have an entire small business line of directional stuff that is exceptionally priced. I mean, we do point-to-point installs for people who can't get internet at a certain point, or they're like, for example, here's a great example. Last month I did one across a parking lot. It was going to cost them about $9,000 to trench the parking lot. And I knew that this one specific Ubiquity device would, I mean, the range is ridiculous. We're talking, you know, a 10-mile theoretical distance on some of these things, even higher. And I said, you know, for, you know, 1/10 of the cost, including labor, we could make a solid connection there. And so I have to completely agree that picking one brand or picking one device that does a specific set of jobs really well is kind of the route to go. And we did that same thing with Ubiquity. And now we're signed up for their newsletter, and I signed up for their partner program. And we get all sorts of stuff where they say, hey, you know that $60 device that you've been buying? Well, you know, if you install this firmware on it, it does 10 more things. And so we've actually been super happy with them. We don't get callbacks. We don't get returns. And there's something to be said about that, because they are still roughly, you know, 10 to 12% more expensive than some of the, you know, the TP Link stuff or some of the Linksys stuff. And, but it doesn't matter. The stability is the most important. We have access points that we put in medical facilities that, you know, they find that we get a call, oh, hey, you know, the wireless isn't working. Can you come take a look? And they've been online for over 400 days without a reboot, rock solid. And the reason they stopped working is usually because of a router issue or a switch issue, or someone ran over a cable or something like that. So I definitely have to agree that going that route is probably one of my biggest tips. If you guys haven't checked out the Ubiquity line of devices, it's a magical place that leaves a lot of margin for the provider.
Very cool. And I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to jump on both these guys' bandwagons. And basically, something that's been burning in me for the last couple of weeks as I read different Facebook groups, and people are constantly doing things like, hey, if I set up this cheap residential router or access point in a business, how can I get these things to work properly? And to that I go, you shouldn't. You should basically be using stuff that is at least business class, even if it's low-end business class, because you're going to get a lot more features for a lot of that stuff when it comes to support, when it comes to being able to take care of your customer, or like Rob said, not having the problems that you have with a lot of this other stuff. You get a lot of these, and I'm not going to name any brands. Everybody knows who they are. There's a lot of cheap brands out there, and for some reason, we want to save the customer money, which I am not against. But here's the thing. Our job as the experts is to basically come to that customer and say, here's the things that you need, and here's what I'm going to provide to you, because I know they work very well for a very long period of time. And I can't say that with some of these other cheaper products. So that's why I'm only going to install these products. If you don't want to do that, you can go elsewhere. Everybody balks at making a margin on this hardware, and it's like, I don't understand it. What do you care what the cost is when technically the customer is paying for it anyways? So again, learn your products, go ahead and know them well so you can go in and be an expert with those products, and stop using cheap stuff. Start being the professionals that we all need to be, and take that next level and go ahead and take that proper equipment and start installing that instead of doing what everybody else does. And I would even say, from the standpoint, even when you're starting out, now sometimes there are times when you inherit things, when you come into a network, you come into a business, the things that are already there, sometimes you're going to have to deal with those. But when it comes time to replacing those, you should have something in place so that you can go in there and do a proper replacement and not just replace garbage with more garbage. All right. And on a brighter note, I don't mean to be so harsh, but these are things that just irritate me, and people are doing it, and they've been doing it for many, many years, and I just don't understand it. All right. So one of the things I want to say is, John was talking about last week, he said, what are we going to do for show 250? Well, for those of you that may or may not know, I have not done all 250 shows of this particular show. There was about 83 episodes when I started. So I have done a fair amount, obviously, 83 to 250. But one of the things that I meant to keep track of and I had forgotten, so I'm going to go ahead and bring the numbers up now because I thought they were interesting. I have been podcasting for about the last 41 months. This is one of the shows I have done during that period of time. So there are over 300 episodes, podcast episodes I've done. And they probably have been roughly about an hour, hour and 15 minutes apiece. So you got about a little over 385 hours of content in the last 41 months. Basically a little over 3 years. And so I just thought that was interesting that I've been podcasting for a fairly short period of time as far as years go, but I've got a lot of content underneath my belt. And so I just want to bring that to everybody's thought processes we're talking about. I don't know any significance of shows as far as 250, 300, 400, 500. To me, it's another show. And I know people appreciate, you know, the things that we do here. So that's why I continue to do them. But I was looking back because I try to keep these records, and I couldn't believe how many episodes I've done in that short period of time. So anyways, that's my numbers for the show 250. Is that good, John?
Well said, Jeff. Well said.
All right. Let's go ahead and take a quick break since I've been talking a lot. And then we'll come back into our main topic for today. Our show today is brought to you by Ninja, the remote monitoring and a management solution to help you become more efficient, more productive, and more profitable. With Ninja, you can have a faster fixed response time and offer preventative maintenance to your customers. Ninja understands what you need to run your business, which is why their RMM solution is integrated with the tools that you use every day. Ninja provides competitive pricing, patch management, antivirus, email, and SMS alerting. You can be up and running quickly with minimum training time, which is what I really appreciate. I need the minimum training time. You have TeamViewer integration for that remote support. It's one solution for managed and non-managed clients alike. Get network visibility inside the RMM. Easy-to-read dashboards, which again, I really like. A powerful device search where you can create custom queries and export the list to show your customers. It also has an executive style report showing important system metrics such as health score, software added or removed, hardware changes, and TeamViewer connections. Gives you all that information all in one spot, one easy to read report. Ninja is offering Podnuts a free 30-day trial, and when you decide to buy, a 10% discount. Take advantage of this offer. Go to info.ninjamsp.com/podnuts. All right, so our topic for today was brought to us by Brian Wheeler. Thank you for this, Brian. He says, one of the topics he had brought in an email to me was about CRM or leads databases and how to use them, how to keep them up to date, etc. So I've got a couple people on this show that I know have gone through several iterations of doing this customer relationship management and what types of information we need and what do we have to have in order to be able to go back and search these records to make them beneficial to even writing them down in the first place, whether it's physically or digitally. So, John, why don't you go ahead and start off in what does customer relationship management or CRM mean to you?
Well, a basic CRM platform takes all of your customer information, consolidates that information, so it's in, let's just say, database format, so it's easy for you to find, retrieve, and taking it further into our topic, to what I would suggest, collate and use that information in order to find new customers. So there's lots of products that do this. I mean, literally 1,000 of them. Standard ones that come to mind are like ProsperWorks, Zoho, Salesforce, Insightly, Nutshell, and about 1,000 more. In our field, customer repair, Autotask is a big one that has a CRM platform, something like Repair Shopper, BusyBench, I believe, has some CRM in it. So
I'll let it's got an element to that. Yeah.
Yeah. So what we want to be able to do with that from our CRM platform, once we have this database of connections or of information, the things that we want to do is be able to automate our sales force, meaning from the fact that it's a lead generation source. We want to be able to market from that database, meaning target customers based on maybe type, location, size, that type of stuff. And then manage the contacts with those customers. And I don't mean a contact list. I mean the contacts, the individual touches that we have. So it might be that Becky called from ABC company. We want to know what Becky was looking for and making notes about that. So for within that CRM, there's a couple things I think you need to consider based on that are when you're looking for a CRM, maybe you pick a niche that works for you and for your customers. You might not want to use Salesforce. If you're a solo tech, you might want to look at BusyBench or Repair Shopper or something that fits. And when I say works for your customers, do you want your customers to be able to peer into your CRM and maybe update their own contact information, integrate with tickets, see their estimates and invoices that are due, and maybe even pay you from that customer relationship management software? I would also make sure to remember to consider things like compliance and the type of customers you're dealing with your CRM. And then the last thing, you know, maybe to consider would be, you know, how much you're willing to pay for that CRM and also the growth of your business. Are you planning on being a solo tech? Do your vendors need access to your CRM? And then plan for growth.
Okay. Very good. And Rob, what does a CRM mean to you, especially since you're running one also?
I am probably the most biased person when it comes to that. I actually very rarely even use that functionality inside of BusyBench, just mainly because I'm a very interactive person when it comes to managing that kind of stuff. So I'm going to take the entire I'm going to be the devil's advocate here on this entire topic, because it's one of those things that I almost feel that we overcomplicate our lives by adding extra things to where we could just handle those things. And I'm just going to put a little snippet here. So for example, let's say if I get a lead. All right. So I get a lead from someone. I'm going to drop what I'm going to do, what I'm doing, and take 2 minutes to call them. I'm going to take a minute to write an email. I'm going to reach out to them. As soon as that contact's been made, it's out of place, out of mind. They have now a provider that's going to offer that service to them. They're not going to keep looking. It's going to kind of put a halt on the whole thing. It's going to set up the schedule, things like that. And to be completely honest, unless it's notable information, such as what they're looking for, which then I might add that to their our CRM has a way to integrate with the customer panel built right into BusyBench. And so I might make a note in there that would say something along the lines of, oh, this person's looking for this. I'm just going to say, I use Siri. Like I just, if something happens, I will just hit the phone immediately and say, hey, remind me to call, remind me to follow up, remind me to do this. There's a certain psychology behind how many times you follow up with someone. Here locally, there's a dealership called Lithia. It's a nationwide, I'm not sure if you guys have heard of that, but Lithia is a very large car dealership that uses a very robust CRM software that actually enforces their salespeople and their service people to constantly follow up. After about the third call, you just stop answering the phone. So there's a certain psychology behind how many times you're going to try to help that customer and the threshold in which you're going to actually frustrate them because you're contacting them too much. So typically what I do is I just bypass all of that because I, like I said, I am in the midst of running three separate you know, entities at the same time. And it's much easier for me, instead of opening up BusyBench or opening up Salesforce or opening up Soho, which I've gone that route before, instead of having a platform to just remind me, I use what my phone already has. And so I'll hit Siri and say, hey, remind me to call John Smith in 2 days and follow up with, you know, this issue or follow up with that issue. And boom, it's in my phone. It's attached to my contacts. It's already got the contact in my phone and it's done. I don't have to pay for an additional platform. Now, the problem with that, okay, there's it's a double-edged sword here. The problem with that is, obviously, I've got no record. I've got no record of how I followed up with them. I've got no record of how I do these certain things. Now, I'm in a different mindset where I'm looking for the golden goose. Okay, the standard person that calls me and says, hey, I've got a virus infection on my computer. I'm just going to direct them. I'm going to put them into the uppercase funnel and the guys can take care of that. The ones that are the 50 person, you know, establishments, the financial institutions, the medical facilities, those are ones that I'm going to go into BusyBench. I'm going to make a user account. I'm going to make an email. I'm going to start making notes because those ones are valuable to me. Inside of BusyBench, we actually have, it's called an account worth. And it seems almost like a shallow feature. It's like, how much did this person pay me? But it's basically what it boils down to. So you can kind of weigh out whether or not this person is worth keeping as a client. And that's a real thing that a lot of people don't like to confront, is the fact that sometimes clients aren't worth the trouble that they're providing. And that could be an entire topic all on its own. But that being said, when I get a decent client, I'll put them in there. And then from there, I can run reports and things like that. But as far as the actual CRM, I don't use anything separate, just mainly because of ease of use. Like, I need to be able to get these things handled immediately. And I don't want a list of people where, like, if you're going to be using a CRM, like really dedicating all your time, most of these platforms are so robust and offer so many features. You basically have to become a salesperson. So you've got to kind of weigh which hat you're going to wear that week. Are you going to be the salesperson? You're going to be the tech? You're going to be the business owner? And I've found that a lot of these platforms are so overwhelming when I can accomplish the same thing by doing a couple, two, three reminders in my phone. But like I said, it does have its double-edged sword. It doesn't, you know, I've got no way of pulling or exporting that data out of my phone to say, okay, how many times have I contacted John Smith? So that's kind of how I leverage all of that. And it's been working really well, but there are benefits and cons to doing that.
Robert makes a good point. I think one of your main points was it's garbage in, garbage out. You could spend a lot of money on a CRM, but if you don't take the time to put all that time and effort into providing the data, the CRM can't provide anything back to you. So that's a great point, Robert.
Well, and I look at some of these platforms and I'll take, Repair Shopper, which is what I'm using right now. And I look at it from a standpoint of when I started my business, I basically had paperwork that I had gotten through the TechNibble computer business kit, which is a great way to start. And I took the information that was in there and I made a one-page sheet where I could have my customers, yes, and I still do it today, I at least get one original inked copy. I don't know why.
We did that too. People sign tickets. So that's not archaic. We do 3,000 residential clients a year. And every single person that walks into our door has a signature on a piece of paper.
Okay. Now, generally, I will only do that the very first time. Once I enter them into my system, I can go back and I can print another ticket from that standpoint. And sometimes I'll have them sign it. A lot of times I won't. It's not that big a deal. But I just originally, when they first come in, I want that original sheet with an ink signature on there that I keep in a file folder. But with that being said, when I was only using paperwork, I would always go and if somebody would call me back up and say, hey, do you remember a year ago when you worked on my computer? And to be honest with you, I probably forgot you about 4 weeks, maybe even less after you walked out my door and picked up your computer and paid me. Not that I forget you altogether, but what I did for you, I have no clue. So I would have to go, and while I'm talking to them on the phone, I'm rifling through all this paperwork to find out where their sheet was so I could pull the information and go, hey, I replaced a hard drive for you, or I did a virus removal or whatever, or I transferred data. So to me, I probably use the customer relationship management or CRM on a light version between my ticketing and invoicing. but I like it because I have a place to input information. And then whenever I'm having a back and forth with the customer, it's all in my system. So that when a customer does call me up and say, hey, do you remember what you did for me a year ago? I can basically go in, start typing their name. Boom, they pop up. Oh, yeah, this is what I did. So it's a very easy way to retrieve that information. And at the same time, I'm with you, Rob. I believe that I don't want to inundate my customers with all this extra emails and all this kind of stuff to bombard them. But I do follow-up emails, and I do it 2 weeks, 6 months, or no, 2 weeks, 3 months, and a year out. So usually, you know, in about a year, you know, so they're only getting three within that time period, and it's just a follow-up. It's real simple. It goes out automatically. I don't have to think about it. So for me, it makes my life a lot easier of having everything in one database. But from the standpoint of, I can see what you're saying as far as if you're getting it on the fly, you can follow up real quick right away and you've already got it. Now, you know, why you're using Siri, I have no idea, but whatever, you know, Apple guys.
So one of the feature requests you would have in your CRM is automation to save you all that time or save you a lot of time.
What, yeah, and that would be nice where with the BusyBench app and to be able to have like some kind of voice integration or something that would say, hey, do this, and it adds it to the BusyBench calendar and it pops into everyone's SLA and it does all of that. That would be fantastic. I think our developer would probably wouldn't talk to me for a week if I mentioned that at this point, but yeah, I could see that coming.
So what types of information do you need to have in a CRM? Because I've heard people in the past say that run businesses that are successful that have trouble collecting simple things like email addresses. But what are some of the basics that we need to have in order to make it beneficial, not only for the customer, but for ourselves? And I just right up front, I am not an advocate for my type of business, because it's mostly residential, to have somebody log in and look and see what I've done for them. I you know, that's fine. It's there. I don't really care about it. I'm going to do the follow-up. I'm either going to make the phone call. I'm going to send the email personally. That's my back and forth. But what types of things do we need in order to make it worthwhile?
Well, I guess I can step into that. The main things that I collect, because when I first started out, I assumed that my customer database would be as robust as it needs to be. It needs to be just, you know, what are their hair color? How, you know, what are their kids' names? When's their dog's birthday? You know, and I wanted to just be able to reach out to them as much as possible. And unless, like I said, unless you're going to be a full-time salesperson and that's all you're doing, 8 hours, 10 hours a day, it's stupid information to collect that no one's going to care about. Now, I'm going to bring up the Lithia thing because this is like, I can see how frustrating it can be. So I went in and had an oil change. And then a week later, I got a call from a salesperson and they asked me about my tires. No, my tires are good. Then I got another sales call saying, do you have any cracks in your windshield? Anything that needs to be fixed? No, my windshield's fine. How are your headlights? And then about 3 weeks later, after getting one of those, every other day or so, someone called me and says, hey, you know, it looks like your car's in great shape. Would you like to sell it? And so it's just like, how far does that go, right? Before that data collection just irritates the customer. And I just block that number now. Like, I don't even care to answer it because it's just so frustrating. And so as I progressed through my business, the things that I was actually collecting were phone numbers, name, email addresses. Realistically, and you can kind of reach out and look these studies up yourself, most people receive so much junk mail and so much advertising that collecting their address is kind of pointless unless it's for bill collecting. So if you say accept personal checks and things like that, and you're going to need to be going after them for collections and whatnot, like we do on occasion, I mean, it's probably twice a year where an address is important, that, you know, you're direct mailing to them. I mean, I can save a lot of people a lot of money. I've spent easily 10 grand over the years doing direct mail and stuff where I have targeted areas, targeted very wealthy areas, targeted very, almost poverty stricken, you know, areas where I can kind of check on both ends. Well, do my customers come from, you know, areas that are, very, very poor? Do they come from very wealthy areas? And they don't come from any area. People don't read spam mail. like people don't read. I printed out, I think we had 2,000 windshield flyers that we had put out, and we did, you know, all sorts of parking lots. We went all over the place. We went that downtown. We did Costco parking lots. We did, and it was when I was first starting out. We got two of those back, and the people that came in were just checking out the store. They didn't even pay for anything. We did a Valpak where they send out coupons, and we were, and just to prove my point, because at the time I was having this argument with one of my managers, and I said, this is stupid. I don't want to spend money on this. Print media is a joke. People throw it away. And he said, okay, well, you know, prove me wrong. So I put $100 service for free on my coupon, complete virus tune-up removal, the whole nine yards, up to $100. We ran that for 6 months at $650 a month. Do you know how many we got in? Two. We got two. So the return on print media is an absolute joke. And so I'm like, you know what? I don't even care about addresses anymore. The stuff that, and here's just a tidbit for people who are looking to spend their marketing dollars as far as possible. Anything print media, people don't care. People skip past ads. It's they're completely immune to it. The stuff that makes money is handshakes and phone calls. Reaching out to that person, touching base with them, knowing their name, making that personal interaction that an ad can't do is what people pay attention to. Costco in my area ran a small business day type of thing. And where you could come in, you could set up a card table. The deal was is that they were trying to generate more renewals and subscriptions to Costco. And so the deal was that you come in and you spend $100 on their executive membership, or you get someone else to sign up. We would go in there with just free tune-up cards, you know, hey, come check us out. And we would go in with 500 of them, and we would get rid of them in about 2 hours. That was the first year. We had about a 75% return, like actual people coming into our store, because we were interacting with the crowd. We were walking up, we were touching their shoulders, shaking their hands, saying, hey, do you have a computer? Do you, you know, we love to just, you know, just have a chance. Please give us a chance. And it was about 75% of what returned. The next year, what we did was we said, well, let's step that up a bit. Let's put up a big LCD screen and say, hey, if you come over and you like us on Facebook, we'll give you a free mouse. We went through 500 mice in 1 hour. And we ended up getting all these people on Facebook, and we were talking to them and we were interacting with them. And still to this day, I'll reach out to the Costco team and say, hey, are you guys having that event again? I mean, I'd really love to be a part of it. They're like, no, we can't get enough people to sign up and blah, blah, blah. And those were the best marketing dollars I ever spent. The direct marketing on Google and Facebook, yeah, those are awesome. But now, I mean, we don't run in any phone books anymore. We don't do ads. We have these things that are called tabletop guides that are put on countertops at restaurants and things like that. And we don't use them. The only thing that we run anymore is there's a thing called a treasure chest. It's a free coupon book. You spend $30 and you get a free service everywhere. Now, for all of that information, you don't need phone numbers or addresses or any of that. So you've got to ask yourself, what do you plan on doing with that data? Are you really going to spend 10 grand to market to the wealthiest part of town, or are you just going to run an ad? So how much of your time through the customer interaction process, where they come into the store and you're taking their stuff in, how long do you want that customer standing at the desk while you ask them for their pet's name and their, you know, their child's biological father's name and, you know, all this crazy information that really doesn't mean anything at the end of the day? What matters to the customer is how quickly they can get in and out. Typically, that's email address, phone number, name. Cool. That's usually what we take. So I know that was a little bit more than what you asked for there, Jeff, but that's kind of my take on it, is that unless you have a clear strategy as what you're going to be doing with that data, it's kind of pointless to collect all of it.
No, Rob, I'm glad you went into those details, because I think that is important, and these are definitely things to think about. John, what things are important to you as far as what things do you like to collect for your customers?
What Rob said.
You can't do that, John. You can, just because he went on for 5 minutes does not mean you can cut back.
That's awesome, man.
No, Rob, I mean, he speaks the truth. You know, I got to admit that I did some marketing at the beginning of my career, which is so long ago that I don't really remember. I had one mailing success and was exactly the opposite of Rob. We ran a Valpak coupon and offered a free hour of service to, you know, Valpak breaks it up into locations. We did that to one location as a test run. And we were inundated. I can't tell you how many we got back. We got a ton. So we said, man, this is the gold. And so I spent a crap load of cash on all the other areas and signed up for a year. I might have got two back the whole rest of the time I did it. So Rob speaketh the truth there as well. You know, one thing you want to definitely take a look at, and I'll put a link in the show notes about this, but anytime you're doing any of this, make sure that you're looking at the communities around you when you're doing your leads database or you're generating, whether it's mailing or where you're going. Even if I love Rob's idea of the Costco, but you might want to carefully choose the Costco you're going to. And what I mean is, like on the west side of the state where I live in Michigan, if you look at government statistics, we fall on the graph between prosperous and comfortable. But if you go up one county, just a little bit north of me, it's at risk or distressed. And I'm talking about financial level and income and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, you may drive 5 miles north and be in a distressed area where they don't have the money for your services. So just keep an eye on that as well.
Okay. That's good. And I want to say that, you know, Taz from the chat room says, John's first flyer was chiseled in stone. I don't know what that means, but...
I'll speak at Taz later.
All right. So now, as far as from my standpoint and what I look at, I'm a little bit different, I guess, when it comes to this. I'm starting to see why there is certain information I might not need. Because one of the things I do collect is I collect, and it takes my customer less than really 5 minutes to fill out the paperwork and sign it the first time. And then I've got the information. They don't have to do it again. But a lot of times so I get their name, phone number, address, email address. And I guess the reason I've always collected information, or at least what I tell my customers, is so that I have several different ways to contact you if need be. Something happens to your phone. I can find you some way to get this computer back to you, because the last thing I want is to hold on to this thing for any reason. So with that being said, the other thing is, every once in a while, and I don't do this every year, but every once in a while, I will take my customer database and I will just do I've done the follow-up postcards, which have worked well as far as just, hey, appreciate your service. If you ever need anything, give us a call back. Not a big deal. A lot of times during Christmas time, I will send out a card to my customer database and just say, hey, you know, happy holidays, Merry Christmas, whatever. You know, appreciate you being a customer and, you know, have a great end of your year, blah, blah, blah. Spend time with family and so on and so forth. So I guess for that personal touch, that is why I think you can get some benefit from having those addresses. But Rob makes a good point that you basically, I'll be honest with you, I don't fill that stuff out. My wife does. Because, again, you have to have somebody that's going to be able to do that and fill out all the information. Again, the inked, you know, handwritten notes is going to go a long way when it comes to contacting those customers, not just trying to get business out of them, but just thanking them for using you. So those are the pieces of information I collect. The other reason too is a lot of times with the addresses, it's nice if I have to do an on-site, because with the you know, repair shopper that I use right now, I can basically go and put that in there, and it's going to give me, when it puts the thing in my Google calendar, I can basically go, hey, I need to go to this address, and all that information is already in there, so I can navigate there with my phone without having to type it in or do anything else. It's already there in my calendar, ready to go. So for me, that's another benefit if you're doing stuff like on-site. Now, if you're not, maybe that information is not real important.
So I guess what you're saying is that it's the time value consideration. Is what you're putting in the system actually generating more free time for you in the end, or generating a better customer relationship? Or is it just a waste of time collecting worthless data?
Well, it's rough, because you kind of need that information, I think, to go back and look. I probably use it on the lesser end, because I don't use it for necessarily the customer relationship portion, other than sending follow-up emails and stuff like that. But I like to have the information for myself in case I need it for various different reasons, like I said, on sites and different things like that, or just getting a hold of the customer either by phone or by via email. So I'm not sure what the best scenario for that is. And again, it's just, I think those are the basics of information. But I know if you go back and look at other sales from realtors and so on and so forth, and we still get some of the stuff nowadays, you'll get things like a happy birthday card. Hey, happy birthday. You know, because they took the time to take our birthday down. What? Well, I'm not going to do that. And I don't necessarily think that that's a good return on investment as far as collecting their birthday. Or, and I've heard this before in the past, years ago, you know, all the kids' names, all the, you know, like Rob was saying, pet names and so on and so forth. I don't know that you need all that information in order to, unless, like Rob said, you have a full-time person that's all they're doing. But even at that point, it gets to a point where it is irritating the customer and you're kind of doing the reverse of what you want to do. Rob, you gave us a scenario with the car dealership. Do you get anything from anybody anymore that kind of irritates you to where you go, why are people still doing this?
Other than merchant services, I think that's kind of it's my biggest one. Not a ton. I think that's kind of one of the biggest ones that like kind of caught me off guard, because I knew how they were doing it, and I was like, wow, that's aggressive. That's aggressive marketing right there. But again, they have a full-time person. Now, if I had someone that I had sitting and doing marketing, you know, 8 hours a day, I would probably have them focusing on that type of information, because any type of lead generation is great for the company if you can actually, you know, execute that sale. But it is a fine line. I mean, how close are you going to get with it? I mean, I have some customers where I send a follow-up email and they get frustrated with me. It's just a, hey, you know, just wanted to check in on you, check in on you and make sure everything was okay. And, you know, they'll email back, why are you emailing me? Yeah, it's fine. Just leave me alone. And so, you know, you've got to kind of like weigh it out. I mean, I've never sent out birthday cards or anything like that, mainly because they usually look like junk. One of the ones after I got my oil changed, I'm periodically, and this is so funny, I'm getting these letters that are handwritten and they don't have a return address, and they're handwritten, and inside of them it's a news article that's been like hand cut out of the newspaper, and it's an auto ad, and it's got a sticky note that's, you can tell it's been like laser printed, but it looks like handwriting, and it says, hey, I saw this and thought of you. And then has like someone's initial, like -J. And so it's really vague and obscure and you don't know who it is. And it forces you to look at the ad like, what is this? And you look at it, it's, hey, do you want a new Toyota? Have you thought of a Tacoma this month? And I almost regret getting my oil changed, because now I am in this infinite like marketing funnel. And so it's, you know, you've got to weigh out where if your customers can't tell that they're in a marketing funnel, then it's probably okay. But to most people, after two interactions, they're done. Like that's kind of the motto that I set up. I'll reach out, touch base. If I don't hear anything back, I'll follow up again, and then I'm done. Like most people, if they're going to pull the trigger or make a decision on a product or a sale, they're going to do it. They're not going to need 10 forms of email contact. They're not going to need you to call their work phone and their cell phone and send them marketing texts and, you know, geographically tell if they're at the mall and then send them an ad. And, you know, that's just, it's not what people need. And so for me, I would have to say it's just, you know, a couple forms of contact and you know, other than that, most of the time I unsubscribe from that stuff. So there isn't a lot that really gets on my nerves. So, but you know, that's my take on it anyway.
I always try to ask myself, maybe would I want to get that information, you know, instead of the pitch, maybe provide something very brief and short that is of value, provide a value message to reinforce instead of, you know, I know Rob kind of said, well, they called me and asked me about my brakes or about my tires, but really that's a sales pitch. I mean, we're all smart enough to know that. You don't give a darn about my tires. You just want me to buy some new ones. But it might be worth the email that if they noticed I haven't been back in 6,000 miles for my oil change, you know, or something like that, a service reminder.
Yeah, I could definitely agree to that.
Well, The other thing that gets me is coming from Rob's story, when he talks about they called and asked him about his tires and headlights and windshield, my first response would have been, I just had it in for an oil change. Didn't you guys check that stuff?
Yeah, exactly. I know.
It's like, you should have known, because obviously, why would you give me the car back if I had a cracked windshield or a broken headlight or whatever, or my tire tread was too low, whatever. That kind of marketing, that is really spammy type marketing. I don't understand why companies. Well, here's the thing. It probably does still work.
Yeah, the conversion rate's probably pretty decent. So it's like, yeah, keep spamming them. Go for it.
Exactly. Which is, it's frustrating for us that we don't want to do that. We want to take care of our customer and make sure that they're taken care of. And we're not just trying to get that next sale, which I think for a lot of us, that's the way it is. I want you to, when I fix your computer or your network or whatever it is I'm working on, I want you to really not have anything to do with me for quite a while. It almost irritates me when you got to contact me again because you have a problem, because I just want you to be good. So now, again, if people are going to contact me and they need to be taken care of, that's a different story. I don't mind that. But I don't know. I think when you take all this stuff into consideration, I think you have to weigh the pros and the cons and really look at what's the best, what's too much, and then even on the other end, what's not enough. And you've got to have that balance in there.
And I think that now would be a good kind of time to kind of mention some of the stuff that I do. One of the sales plugs that I do when I reach out to people for, we do a lot of stuff with Synology and with Ubiquiti. Synology has actually got to be one of my all time favorite brands. I have way, way too many of them floating around and I know way too much about them. And every once in a while, when there's a security patch or something like that, I know certain clients that we've deployed those for. And what I'll do is I'll reach out or I'll send them an email and say, hey, I just noticed the security patch. You know, I'll specifically say, let your IT team know that this is out so this can get patched. Now, if their in-house IT person didn't know about it, that makes us look really good. And if they don't have an in-house IT person, they're not going to know how to update it. And so it's more or less of me reaching out and just saying, hey, you know, it looks like a security vulnerability. I thought of you because we deployed this. Just think about it. I'm not asking for anything, just letting you know, giving you some information, just being friendly. And more often than not, that actually turns into a job. People will, you know, call us up and say, hey, you know, I saw your email. Is this something I need to be concerned about? And then it kind of starts a dialogue where I'm like, you know, yeah, it's important to get those Synologies updated, you know, and there have been security patches in the past for those, like when, what was that? CinoBlocker? No, not CinoBlocker. CinoLocker, I think it was the crypto virus for the Synologies that were specifically knocking on the external admin accounts for the Synologies way back in, you know, DSM 4.8 and 5.1 and stuff like that. And so we sent out emails and said, hey, you know, this is just something to think about. You know, we're not asking for any, you know, we're not pitching anything to you. Just keep it on the horizon. We already sent you documentation on how to log into it and take care of it. Just think about it. We want you to be safe. And that worked really well for us. And so that's kind of the marketing direction that I go when I'm doing that direct contact, is I try to add a bit of value where I'm not asking for anything in return. And there's a whole, I can't pronounce the word. It's the law of reciprocity. Is that how it's pronounced? It's where if you, I can't pronounce the word, but it's where when you give someone something of value. So if you walk up to someone in the street and you hand them a dollar, psychologically, for no reason, hey, here's a dollar. I'm going to give this to you. You know, have a good day. They are inclined to repay that debt. They're inclined to say something nice. They're inclined to reach out to you. And so we've noticed that law actually works really well for us, that if we reach out, we give them something and ask for nothing and just walk away, we will actually see a huge return in value where they come back to us because they see it. They're like, oh, you know, they didn't have to tell me this. They didn't have to give me this. Another really good one is I will randomly just give flash drives to companies. I'll pull up, they're a client I don't have. I have a specific business card that says, when was the last time that you backed up your data? And it's a flash drive with our logo on it. Now, people throw away pens, people throw away bookmarks, they throw away business cards, they throw away all that junk. People typically don't throw away flash drives because there's an inherent value in that flash drive. They're like, oh, I'll toss it in the desk. Well, surprisingly, that flash drive is going to stay in their desk for 2 or 3 years. So every time they open their desk, they're going to see your logo, right? And so I'll stop by companies that we haven't done business with, and I'll tell them, hey, you know, we offer cloud backups, we offer imaging, but the number one thing that we see that people, you know, are really devastated about is they lose their QuickBooks. You know, your QuickBooks, once your QuickBooks is gone, your whole company's, you know, gone. Here's a 2 gig or here's a 4 gig flash drive. And, you know, next time you guys need a computer repair or something, just think of us. That's all. And I leave. And I'm absolutely shocked at how many people will actually give us a call because of that exact rule of just giving them something and not asking for anything in return, because there's a perceived value of that flash drive. And so I don't know if that helps at all, but that that would be my take on that.
No, that's really good. I like that. And you know what? That's thinking outside the box, because you're right. A lot of that other stuff is throwaway, where somebody is probably going to keep a flash drive and use it for whatever and be able to see that logo all the time. Now, I know Taz says, I would never accept a flash drive, but here's the thing, and it goes along to the customer relationship. If I walk in and you and I have a 2-minute conversation and I'm just introducing myself, if you and I don't have a good rapport at that point and you don't know me from anybody, I can read people in about less than 30 seconds usually. And so, again, I'm not going to want to do business with somebody that I can't trust, and it should be vice versa. So either you're going to trust me or you're not. But yeah, I do understand the dangers in that, you know, as far as a flash drive or whatnot. But I, for the most part, hey, if you're a friendly person, you're coming in and you're actually trying to do good things, I think stuff like that is fine. John, what types of things do you use to foster that relationship with your customers?
Well, I do use my primary business owner's birthday dates. About a year ago, I quizzed all of them and said, hey, send me your birthday. So what I do is, you know, I do the usual little text to them, just a little blurb, hey, hope your day's a great one, blah, blah, blah. But they also get in the mail, or not in the mail, but via email, a little PDF packet from me that says, hey, happy birthday. Time for our annual review. When are we setting up a time to meet?
Yeah, so, personalized text. That's actually a really good idea. I have to just say that's awesome, man.
So yeah, so I get a little, I have a calendar invite in there from Google that says, hey, it's their birthday today, which also prompts me to send out this other email that says, hey, happy birthday. Time for our annual review. So, you know, it prompts me for two things. One, I try to, if I see it in the calendar, I try to be first, and I make a little fun with that to say, hey, I hope I'm the first one to wish you a great day. Hope you're, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I'm sort of first in mind, and maybe they think, well, hey, he does care, which I do. And then the second one would be, you know, got to get that annual review in. Why not do it around your birthday? Maybe I'll take them to lunch or something like that.
Now, does that always coincide with their birthday, with the annual review?
That's the way I set it up.
That's good. That's thinking ahead. I like it.
So I try to kill two birds with one stone.
You are smarter than you look.
So, John.
I'm probably a lot smarter than I look, Jeff.
John, do you track who your biggest fish are and keep track of those in any way? Or are they just kind of, it's a giant bucket?
I do. You know, one, since I have about 45 active clients that I bill on a monthly retainer basis, so maybe it's easier for me than a lot that might have hundreds of retail clients. But, you know, and then within that core group of my 45, I do try to make sure that I have that, you know, with the Diamond Club members, which I would call them, that top 25%. And then the ones that I also label, which you mentioned earlier, Rob, is the problem children, which maybe aren't worth doing the business for. So, you know, maybe at the end of the year, or maybe when I'm frustrated, I'll jump into QuickBooks and do some reporting and to see, is it worth my time? Is it time for a rate increase for this customer? You know, that kind of thing.
That's what I was just going to say, was we actually have a whole line item, and we made I can't remember what it's called. I think it's called, like, someone just made a stupid name for it. It's called the Barbara Streisand fee or something, just so it's masked. And it's anytime a customer has required more time and labor than they've paid, and we'll give them, you know, we'll try them a couple times. And then if they're just totally, totally out of the realm of reality, then yeah, we'll try to phase them out by increasing rates. for that exact reason, because they're, and this is kind of a problem in the IT industry, is people tend to hold on to every client that walks through the door because they're almost desperate, when they don't realize that the person that's going to walk in after your problem child is the one that's going to pay you four times more than they were worth. And so it's something to think about. But for me, I track my big fish. My little fish, typically I haven't seen a ton of return on, but my big guys, one of them is a financial institution, and I actually track his worth. And I know that he typically comes in probably every month or so, maybe every 2 months. And it actually worked in my favor this last couple of months, because I reached out to him and I said, hey, I just directly called his cell phone and said, hey man, I haven't seen you in a while. I just wanted to check in on you and make sure everything's okay. And he goes, well, actually I'm at the Mayo Clinic. I've got this really bad illness going on, and it's crazy that no one else has called me. And I said, well, yeah, I mean, I usually talk to you on a monthly basis. It's just odd that I haven't heard from you. And we ended up, just shooting the breeze and talking a little bit. And he said, I have to, from a professional standpoint, I super appreciate you calling and checking in. And then later on, about a week later, I sent him an email and said, I made a reminder on my phone with Siri, hey, send him an email. And a week later, I sent him an email and said, hey, I hope, the results turned out okay. I hope you're feeling better. Let me know. And not even 3 days later, his receptionist was dropping off stuff at the store again. So there is something to be said for that personal interaction. That means a heck of a lot, and I really like the birthday text idea. I think that's something I'm gonna definitely implement.
At the Unconvention, Brian Best, as part of his keynote or whatever, talked about this a little bit, where he took on what he thought was going to be a great client, but it ended up being a problem child client. And not only did he lose money on that client, but that problem child sucked up so much of his time that he lost other good clients because he couldn't pay attention to his good clients. So, that's also another focus. Just be wary about that you're not spending all your time on the noisy clients and your good clients.
Squeaky wheels.
Yeah, that don't complain, but really do need service, but they like you, so they're not all over you all the time, aren't feeling left out. So.
And the customer worth is a really big thing for us, because it will we're trying to tie together we're trying to find a way of how to connect a client to a referral. So say, for example, someone walks in your store and buys a $5 cable. Well, if you look up that customer later on down the road, okay, that customer is only worth $5. They're not even going to go in a callback, like, cool, they bought a cable, whatever. How do we tie that information to potential leads? And what brought this up was, there was actually a gentleman way back in the day that he worked for a... I want to say it's Living Opportunities here, where they give disabled people jobs and stuff like that. He had come in and he just had talked to me a little bit, and he ended up generating $26,000 or $28,000 a year in revenue of recurring, and he never spent a penny with me. And so that's also something to look at, is not necessarily the individual, but what the individual's worth at in the community that you're living in. So if that individual has a giant, like for example, Costco, the guy who works in the electronics, I buy him annually, like I give him gift cards and stuff for just mentioning us, and all, because he'll send people our way. Oh yeah, you've got a problem, but go check these guys out. And so I'll stop in, I'll shake his hand and say, hey, take your wife out to dinner, go buy a nice Christmas present or something. I think one year I gave him like a $250 Visa gift card. I came in right before Christmas and said, hey, you've done really great stuff for us. And then those referrals keep coming. Now that person individually has never walked into my store. He doesn't even know what the interior of my store looks like, yet he sent us thousands of dollars of business. So thinking a little bit outside of the box there, trying to find a way of also, noting who in your system are your big fish that aren't even on the radar, is also something worth taking note of.
Very good.
Excellent too. And I would also suggest one more thing on the medium-sized fish, because a lot of the times when guys run their reporting in QuickBooks, they've got people in the middle kind of get ignored, because they might not be the high dollar clients you have. But also take a look at those clients to say, hey, boy, I'm making a nice little chunk of change on this client, and they are absolutely no trouble at all. They're just easy money. So a lot of times those easy money clients get stuck in the middle. So, make sure you're not ignoring them either.
Excellent points all the way around, gentlemen. All right. I think we have probably done enough on this topic at this point. If everybody's ready to move on, we'll go ahead and do that. A lot of great points from both sides, and definitely something to think about and look at for everyone's customer base out there. Things I didn't think about in as far as taking care of your higher end clients, and even as John said, medium clients, because yeah, there are a lot of those that don't require as much from you. So that's good. Let's go ahead and we're going to take another quick break, and then we'll go into our next section. If you want to support this show, you can go to patreon.com/computer repair podcast. And our newest patrons are Paul Moore and Devin Hamilton. Thank you, Paul and Devin. Appreciate that. And I want to thank all the rest of our Patreon supporters for your continued support. You all make this show happen. All right, let's answer some emails and take some calls. Phone lines are open. The call-in number is 1-888-697-0162. Let's go ahead and start off with a voicemail. And let me go ahead and cue this up.
Hi, Jeff of the Podnet people. Got back yesterday from Microsoft Ignite. Very interesting, very scary. Everything that Microsoft is pushing towards the cloud, they've probably been doing it for many years, and we weren't really paying too much attention. I don't know if you covered the keynote, but it'd be nice if you had a discussion regarding really what's the next 5 to 10 years going to look like in IT. Obviously, everything is going to the cloud. Azure Active Directory, into managing your PCs and your deployments. It was really, really, really was an eye-opener for myself. Wanted to see what everybody else's opinion was. All right, I'll listen to you guys and watch your show. Bye-bye.
And thank you for that email. If you are calling and leaving an email, I will say that one of the things I would ask people to do is, number one, is let us know your name. Maybe the name of your business and where you're located. So we can kind of track that stuff. It would be interesting to see where everybody comes from. So as far as, yeah, MS Ignite didn't go. I know there was probably lots of people that do go. And I hear about it all the time, pretty much every year. As far as moving to the cloud and different things that are going on, Rob, what do you think the landscape is going to change to over the next 5 to 10 years? I understand we don't have a crystal ball, but at the same time, everybody's kind of got an idea of what we're looking to do.
Well, I definitely have to say that there, even when, if you remember back when Windows 10 was going to be rolled out, there was a bunch of rumors that it was going to be able to repair itself and, you know, do self-restore and all this stuff. And all the IT people basically got, you know, fearful. I'm going to lose all this money. I'm going to do all this. All I have to say is end users, like they're always going to exist. It doesn't matter if you migrate everything to the cloud. I mean, I have hundreds of subscriptions a month where all we do is we help them on break fix stuff for their company. And these are people that don't know how to set Microsoft 365 passwords. These are people that don't, you know, we legitimately, and I'm not even joking, I will get a service call. I got this a couple of weeks ago where they didn't know what all the icons on their desktop were, and they wanted the ones that they don't use deleted. So they wanted a tech to remotely connect to them to delete their icons off their desktop. And so it's nothing to be fearful for. If anything, the best thing you can do is embrace it. Anytime that, not think of it as, and it's going to be hard for some of the techs that are kind of set in their ways. And I know of a few of them, even in my hometown, they are dedicated to certain hardware. They're dedicated to certain ways that they work. And it's going to be an adapt or survive situation. If you learn the platforms, like we leverage Office 365 all the time. And we ask people, you know, do you want us to manage it? Do you need help with it? Do you want to do a service agreement? Do you want us to train you on how to use it? Do you know how OneDrive works? And so, you know, it's more of an adapting. These bigger companies out there that are offering these SaaS platforms are giving opportunity along with not necessarily taking it, but making it a heck of a lot easier. With the stuff moving to the cloud, I mean, everything we have, it's now more cost effective for us to take all the servers out of our locations and put them up into, you know, the Amazon cloud, because it costs less per month than it does for electricity. And so whether you like it or not, it's going to be moving that direction. And whether you adapt to that and add new services, I mean, we add new services all the time. You know, we've got now Office 365 migrations built into our inventory system. It's all, you know, timed out, ticketed out, and all that stuff. If you don't adapt with it, unfortunately, you're going to be, you know, having a hard time paying your bills when the only thing you know how to do is you know, run malware bytes and do a tune-up on a computer. And so what I would have to suggest is, as you hear these things come out, become completely involved with them. Do as much research as you can, understand how you can leverage it in your business, and be that IT person that it knows that this exists and can leverage it in those businesses and or in the lives of your customers, and be that professional that they're looking for, instead of the person that goes, well, no, I don't know about that cloud stuff. I mean, the cloud stuff is pretty dangerous. Now, what's more secure, having your email hosted in your house behind your Linksys firewall, or in behind Microsoft's data center where people are paid a few million a year to make sure people don't, you know, hack into it? I'm going to have to vouch for the cloud. Yes, there are cloud vulnerabilities. Obviously, we've seen the Equifax thing, and we've seen all this other stuff and blah, blah, blah. Those are inherently a risk. Yes, I understand that. The cloud can be scary, but the cloud is also becoming more and more secure with every one of these breaches. It's just like with Busybench. Every time we notice a bug, or we notice an issue, or we see something, it gets that much better. And so the one thing I would have to say, as far as the landscape goes, yes, things are going to be going to the cloud. And you can see that with the Microsoft Education Edition, where they're pushing a lot of the, you know, very small hard drives and work out of the cloud and do all that. And I'm going to totally embrace it, because I absolutely hate having multiple computers and all this data all around, and have Dropbox and everything, and sync this and sync that. And I don't necessarily want to run an Active Directory and yada, yada. If I had one place that I can dial in, I would be super happy. And that being said, okay, there is a local company that actually went out of business that were leveraging alternative services for those cloud related platforms. So, for example, there was a data center out of Portland that was hosting like remote desktop for local businesses, which was kind of interesting. And what they did was they built an entire industry off of logging into those systems and backing up that data out of the cloud onto local devices for them, so that they had a physical copy if that data set ever went down. And so don't look at it as the landscape's changing and you need to, you know, you're going to go out of business. Look at it as, I now have a ton of opportunity. I need to adapt and learn what's out there and how I can leverage that to my clients.
Very well said. I like that. John?
Jeff, I like the idea of being a cloud MSP for my RMM, AD, DCE, FTP, and MSP for my single pane of glass for ROI and greater productivity.
Okay, just stick a fork in it. We're done. You rat.
I don't want to take away from what Rob just said. I mean, that's 100%. He's 100% on. And I would suggest, you know, to his point, that the one thing, if you go back and listen to the Microsoft keynote, you know the one word they don't say during the entire keynote? Windows. So, I mean, we're moving away. I mean, you know, that's just becoming a small portion of the tool. I mean, what we're going to need to know is a lot more than just what we're used to doing on the endpoint. So I guess that's my point.
See, what it is the NSA just decided, you know, as a whole, that it's way too hard to log people's browsing history if it's on individual operating systems. So we put them all in one server that we own, right? Then we know what everyone's doing.
Because then the FBI and the IRS and the FCC and the FTC can all track. I'm sorry. I'll stop. I go, right.
Well, one of the things, too, that a lot of people don't think about, there are certain things that you're going to still have to have on-premise. And I think that's going to be like that for a long period of time. Here's the thing. I'm a gamer. A lot of people know that. I build a very high-end rig that I can game pleasantly when I have time, which is rare and rarer. But anyways, I still enjoy it to a certain extent. And so there will never be a day, I'll be 90 years old, I will still have an on-premise rig that I'm going to play my video games with, because who knows where the bandwidth is going to be, but it's still never going to be. Listen, Wi-Fi is not as good as wired.
Well, hold on. Let me pause you there. Wait one second, Jeff. Hold on. We gotta put a pause here. Okay, do you remember when OnLive came out? Do you know what OnLive is? Okay. So yes, complete and total flop. I give him that. However, Okay. Now, if I had a little box that was kind of like, let's say, the Amazon Fire TV, and it cost me $100 and a $30 a month subscription, and that computational power was done in the cloud where the graphics were beautiful and everything else was just stunning, and I could plug a keyboard and mouse into it and it tied into my Steam account, my Ubisoft account, and all of that, I would probably do it if the frame rates were good and the bandwidth could handle it. Now, if anyone was going to do that, Amazon would probably be the ones to actually successfully do it. But realistically, you can't say, okay, with the way that things are going, that you would forever have a rig, because I do. I have a gaming rig. You know, my girlfriend has a gaming rig. We all have gaming rigs. But if you could buy a $100 box that performed exactly the same, or let's say with a 5% margin of suck, okay, almost identically the same, there, you can't say that you wouldn't at least try the idea and possibly switch to it.
Okay, I'll give you that. I just don't think that it's going to be a reality in my lifetime.
Oh.
Here's the reason I say that. Because a lot of times when you're thinking about, and this is going to go down a rabbit trail, but when you're talking about gaming, I am not a console gamer because I don't consider those real gamers. I am a PC gamer.
Oh, wow. Holy cow.
I just really stepped in it right there.
There's a storm of peasants that are going to start chatting.
Jeff, nobody likes you already, and then you're going to go here? Jeez.
Where's your PC Master Race t-shirt?
So here's the thing, though. Part of it is because I like the graphics in my games. And so the processing power for the graphical interface or the graphics for the video game are done on-premise. Now, when I'm playing a multiplayer game, a lot of times it's smooth as silk because it's just sending bits of information of where my character's moving, left, right, forward, back, whatever. And so it can do that on the fly. Here's the other caveat. And these are things we're all going to be running into. So this is a whole nother rabbit trail. But I'm already getting overcharged because I use a terabyte of data in my household every month. And so Comcast deems it necessary that they want to charge me more money because I'm in the 1%. Now, I always wanted to be in the 1%, just not when it comes to my data. I was thinking more along the lines of money. That was kind of my 1%er, but hey, I'm not. So I'm a 1%er in something, but these things are going to have to be worked out over time. And maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't. But I'm leaning towards right now, from what I've seen, we'll see. I don't think it, I think it's going to be, if it does happen in my lifetime, it'll be a very long time from now. So my point being to all this, as we go down this rabbit trail, is that there are still things that are probably going to be better on-premise for some things. And then there are going to be other things that are absolutely going to be much better in the cloud. And so I think you're going to have a little bit of hybrid on both sides. That's just my opinion.
Well, I can agree to that. And you can kind of see that a lot with like the Amazon devices where they do have like the Fire TV versus the stick. The Fire TV performs way better because of the quad core, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, I can see that. I think you are being very ambitious by saying that not in your lifetime. I mean, come on, man. We've got in the last 4 years, we've gotten cars that could drive themselves. We've got, you know, Elon. I mean, look at this guy. I mean, here in a year, we're going to be flying to France for $100, man.
That's pretty old, Rob. So it might not be that much longer.
Well, you know. All right. So anyways, Rob, I'm sure you and I will be friends down the road and we'll be talking about this years from now. And we'll see which way it goes. I've got time.
I'm gonna send you that newsletter when Amazon rolls out the Echo gaming console.
Well, again, like I said before, console gamers are not real gamers.
They are peasants, I know.
Jeff, it wasn't that long ago when you were on Prodigy Online. So
look how far we've
come. Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy.
That hurts. That hurts just thinking about it. I was only on dial-up for a minute, thank God. All right, let's move into an email. Okay, this is from Bradford Torrey. He says, just catching up on podcasts, and I was listening to the discussion between Marvin, John, and Paco regarding raising rates. Good discussions all around. I would agree with John. Don't ask. Don't discuss with clients. Just do it. Annually, you should be raising rates to some degree, $5 an hour, annual increase will be accepted without much or any discussion. If you have a monthly managed client, increase something similar based on the size of the business and the monthly. My rule of thumb is this: if they keep calling you for support and they don't question the bill, you need to charge more. Aha. Obviously, I'm fair about it, but we do quality work. We look out for the best interests of the client at all times. So what we charge for and how much we charge needs to reflect our skills. We've been quietly raising our rates for the past 2 years and no problems. I personally set a rate to reflect how I feel about my own level of expertise. I'm getting to be a little cocky. The networks we build and the knowledge I have is worth some Benjamins. I'm very fair with invoicing. If I screw up, I don't charge for the time to fix my screw up. If I feel that something is taking longer than it should because my knowledge is lacking, then I charge less hours. But if you have something weird, I do charge for the time to learn. So my rates are maybe high, but they are fair. And I don't apologize or discount anymore. It doesn't seem to be hurting things in the slightest. Brad Torrey from TTCS Computer Services. Thank you for that, Brad. Appreciate it. So, John, that was a good discussion that was a while back that we had that discussion about raising rates. And I know you were definitely about you need to have some sort of rate increase. Rob, how do you feel about that as far as what do you do for raising of your rates on a regular basis?
You're going down the road of the biggest cancer in the IT field. I mean, invoicing seems to be the biggest, hardest thing. Whenever I talk to another tech or I talk to another, you know, an MSP, they typically, it's always, you know, they'll do work that they don't charge for, or they, you know, step over where, you know, all that stuff, and they don't increase their rates and yada, yada. For us, we have a flat rates. You know, you bring stuff in, everything's kind of itemized out. It's a lot like a menu. We did have a minimum wage increase here, so we did increase a few things across the board to kind of, you know, adjust to that. But as far as what we charge, when I first started out, before we had any commercial clients, we're doing only residential. As most people start out, you know, they start out residential, they get their feet wet, they learn their, you know, they learn their trade, then they move more into commercial. We were charging like $25 an hour. You know, and that was just, it was okay because I felt that was good. I mean, before that I was making like, you know, $11 an hour at my previous job before I started my business. So, you know, to me, that was a good idea. Now, realistically, people see this field as something that is, you know, that you take a lot of years to hone, and it's okay to charge for that. I mean, we charge our onsites right now are set at $95 an hour. If we have to go on site, whether it's residential or commercial, you're getting the same tech. And so cool. You know, you're a residential client, but you're getting a commercial tech. You're getting a person that can sit down and, you know, completely configure a Cisco gateway by himself. You know, it's like, you know, you're getting, just because you have, you know, lesser hardware doesn't mean you're not getting the same amount of knowledge. And so across the board, once we acquired one of my competitors, we swooped in and bought them up a couple of years ago. He had told me, oh yeah, we charge $95 an hour. At that time I was charging $65. He said, just raise it to 95. If anyone questions it, you don't want them as a client. Now that was a big hurdle for me. That was massive. I was like, wow, that is a huge jump. I have so many clients that I'm going to lose. So going from 65 an hour to 95 an hour, that's a pretty decent jump. And we did it overnight. Anyone who called in, we said, hey, just FYI, we charge $95 an hour now. If you want us to come out, you're welcome to. Now, what they're going to do is they're going to go, whoa, 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 whoa. They're going to back off a little bit and they're going to start price checking. Now, to find someone in town, they're probably going to go to Best Buy. You're looking at over $100 an hour. They're going to check out your other competitors who probably have been established for a while, and they're going to be somewhere in that price range too. Now, if you live in an area where your economics are really low and the overall, you know, a $95 an hour may seem really high to you depending on where you're listening to this show. I mean, it's Southern California, I'm sure $200 an hour is okay. You know, whereas in Nebraska, $17 an hour is high. You know, it really depends. For us, $95 an hour is very, very reasonable. And we do reevaluate that annually, but we also weigh out where and what we're doing. If we ultimately want to, I mean, the goal is to move as much into the commercial space as possible to justify those rates. Now, you can't just throw a cost out there and say, okay, this is what it costs, take it or leave it. You have to add value. And that's a whole thing that, you know, could be in an episode on its own of just talking about, you know, company shirts and there's so much that goes into adding value to that where your customer isn't going to cough at that. If you show up in, you know, a wife beater that's got mustard on it and, you know, you've got your laptop that's, you know, broken screen and you show up and, you know, and I've heard these stories. I mean, there's a couple techs in my hometown that, you know, I've actually referred work to because I was busy and I just didn't have time to do it. And I get emails back and say, and this is legit, said this technician showed up drunk and he was belching all the time and yada, yada. And I sent him a very stern email and said, I will never send you another person. There's a lot to be said as far as your value per hour is. And when you're looking at rates, 5% annually is, I think, pretty fair. But there is a threshold. There's certain techs in town and there's certain businesses that charge, you know, almost 2.5 times what we charge per hour. And that threshold is few and far between. Now, if you're only going after the golden goose, then charge all you want, but you better be able to justify it. Have a good website, have good tools, have the knowledge, solve the problems quickly, and make them feel as if what they're paying that premium for is the better product. Think of it as the same way as you go to the store. If you're going to go to the store and you're going to buy shampoo, now everyone probably knows that almost all shampoos are created equally for the most part. Now you can buy the 99-cent Suave or you can buy the $7, you know, fancy hair shampoo that is going to do everything but give you a 401k. And you're looking at these two bottles and you're like, well, what's the difference? Well, the perceived value is the marketing, how it's packaged, how it's delivered, reviews, things like that. So if you are going to raise your rates, make sure that on all fronts you're comfortable, your website's updated, you know, your image is updated, you've got a good logo, you're professional, you're following up with these customers, or else you're just not going to be successful. That's the bottom line. People aren't going to pay that rate. You're going to have to reduce your rate. And then if you go from a higher rate down to a lower rate, that looks really, really bad. So, you know, that's just that there's my take on it is that we do annual increases where we reevaluate. And then beyond that, we keep most of the stuff flat rate in-house.
Very good. I like that.
Thanks for that shampoo comment, Rob. I appreciate that.
Sorry. You know, the other thing that a lot of people don't consider, a lot of people will, let's say a person is making $20 an hour at a job and they go, hey, I can charge $50 an hour for fixing computers, which I'm just doing on the side. The problem with that is that thought process is when you actually go down and look at the soft costs that you have to pay in your business. If you're doing it legitimately, i.e. taxes, tools, et cetera, those soft costs will eat into customer acquisition. All that eats right into that $50 an hour. And then once you do all the math, a lot of times you go, wait a minute, I'm only actually netting 10 bucks an hour from this $50 an hour customer because of all these other costs that I have to incur.
Or if when you're starting out, you're actually in the negative because of all of the initial costs, right? So you went out and you ventured out to do this $50 an hour job. Well, it's costing you $75.
Exactly. So you definitely have to look at that stuff and you can't just, you know, we won't do a John Dubinsky and just pull something out of the air like John's so good at. But, you know, John's been doing it for so long that he can do that. But yeah, definitely some things to look at. So again, Brad, appreciate you bringing that up. It is a sore subject, as you have said, Rob, with a lot of people. But hopefully we bring enough light to it to where people can go, you know what? I really need to think about that a little bit more.
And I just one last note. The biggest thing that I see is the fear to charge.
Yes.
Like, and I deal with it with my manager. I deal with it with my other techs. They have so much empathy for the customer that they feel bad for charging. Just stop. Just get out of that mindset. If you go and you get your oil changed or someone comes out and fixes your window or you get your carpet cleaned, do they ever say, oh, you know what? I feel kind of bad for you. I'm going to give you a discount. I'm going to help you out. No, they send you a bill. and that's the end of it. And so you need to just wake up tomorrow and be completely out of that mindset, because that is a crippling, cancerous mindset that will just lead you down an unprofitable rabbit hole.
Yep, I agree. Most definitely. All right. I'll tell you what, I think we have come to the end of our time this week. John, can you give us one parting thought?
Show me the money.
That's a good parting thought, John. And you can tell people where they can find you at.
John@mavengroup.net.
Awesome, man. Appreciate you coming out.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
And Rob, it has been a pleasure as always. And if you can give us one parting thought and let people know where they can find you, that would be awesome.
I would have to say, never stop innovating. I mean, as soon as you think you've done a great job, reevaluate that and keep going. I think that's what's kind of motivated me this entire time, is once I've completed something, I just ask myself, what's next? And I think that's kind of the key to progression there. So that is my parting thought. Anyone that wants to reach out to me, you can reach out to me at Robert@busybench.com.
All right. Appreciate that. And definitely, Rob has always been one of those people that he answers questions and loves to interact with other techs and business owners out there. So definitely appreciate, and he always brings a bunch of great knowledge to the show. So we definitely appreciate that. All right, come join us live for the Computer Repair Podcast every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern over at podnets.com/Computer Repair Podcast Live. Join in on the conversation by calling in live and hanging out in the chat room. You can also send an email to podnuts@podnuts.com. Really easy to remember. Or you can leave a voicemail like our caller did earlier at 1-888-697-0162. We have audio available over at podnuts.com or subscribe using your favorite podcatcher. You can be notified when the show is live by subscribing to our YouTube channel, Computer Repair Podcast. Well, thank everyone for listening and subscribing to the show. We'll see you next time on Podnuts, the Computer Repair Podcast.
Music provided by Steve Cherubino at stevecherubino.com.